Back at it with you, wrapping up the month of September 2020 on Wednesday, September 30th. Again, the status of high school football and other sports up in the air. We talked about that in the 3 o'clock hour with high school sports reporter Sean Patrick Boley from Hearst Connecticut Media. More post-debate analysis in the 4 o'clock hour with Quinnipiac University political science professor Scott McLean. And in the 5 o'clock hour, former Lieutenant Governor candidate Monty Frank talked about his work to reform voting and how we do it in Connecticut. My comment. What a train wreck. What, you know what that was? You know what we're talking about. The debate last night, that was a multi-car pileup on the Merritt Parkway. That was a multi-vehicle accident on 95. That was just, oh. How are you? 208, 8 past 2 o'clock. It is a Wednesday, the day after whatever that was last night. Right here on Connecticut Today. It's Paul Pacelli, your old buddy here. Hope you are well. Kind of a transition day with the weather. Aaron Zaltman will keep us updated on that all afternoon. Traffic and weather together on the sixes. We're here till 6. More Yankee playoff baseball tonight. Boy, the Bats woke up last night in Cleveland, huh? So we'll see if the Yankees can end it tonight or go to a game 3. Anyway, I'm here. You're there. 203-333-9422. 203-333-9422. WICC. It's an easy number. Remember it. Write it down on the fridge. Program it in your smartphone, your cordless phone. A lot of people still use those in the house if you have a hardline phone. Your hands-free dialing mechanism in your newfangled car there. Or, again, as I like to remind you every day, make sure you tattoo it on an intimate part of your body that only you and that special someone can see. Most times, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Producer Eric back at WICC Control in the Warp Core in the Nerve Center. Eric asked me a couple of seconds ago, so what do you think? And I said, well, just wait. Give me a shot. I'll let you know what I think. That was that last night. That was awful. And it was awful on both sides. Clearly. The tactic of President Trump last night was to try and rattle Joe Biden's cage. He thought he was going to come out and get sleepy Joe Biden. Now, Biden wasn't especially sharp. I mean, this was a brawl with two guys. It wasn't really on one side or the other. Biden got caught on a couple of moments, which you knew were going to happen, but the president wasted those. And boy, where to start on this? Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, White House confidant, he apparently had done some debate prep with the president over the last week or so. He was asked on ABC, is this what you wanted? Is this what you anticipated? And in so many words, I'm paraphrasing here, Mr. Christie said, no. He said the idea was to be aggressive at the beginning, but he said this went way over. The president thought he was going to, again, to have Sleepy Joe there. Let me rattle the guy's cage. Hockey parlance, if I can, as I often do. Teams try and intimidate each other. They start the period sometimes with their third or their fourth line, which is their muscle line. Oh, geez. Why isn't he putting out his sharpshooters? Well, because he wants to send a message. And sometimes you even have what they call line brawls, where the express reason that a bunch of players are out there on the ice is to, you know, start a fight and intimidate the other side. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It clearly didn't work last night. One thing I think that was lost on the president last night, and I'm sure he was warned about this, folks, you know, between Chris Christie and the other White House people, these people aren't stupid. These people have looked at tape. Again, this is like a sports analogy. You know, when you're prepping for a debate, it's like prepping for a game in the NFL. You break down tape. Look at the hand motion, the hand gestures. What is our opponent doing? What are his or her crutches that he or she falls back on? If they say this, if they say that, you'll know you got them cornered. Where are they weak? Where do we want to go? Again, it's like a football team. You know, they're the number one run defense in the league, so maybe running between the tackles is not what we do here. How do we attack it? Same thing in debates. Okay, this, and again, this requires, it requires a commitment. It requires, it requires, again, as in sports, discipline, staying with the game plan. And Chris Christie pretty much admitted last night the president didn't. Issue one here, as the great John McLaughlin used to say, issue one was that this wasn't Hillary Clinton. And it clearly wasn't Hillary Clinton. Clearly. When he was going up against Hillary Clinton, she had huge, like he did 4 years ago, huge negatives. So he had a built-in advantage going in. And I think he kind of knew, if you look back at those 2016 debates, he wasn't yelling or screaming. He wasn't belligerent. Now, whether that was a tactical thing by him or his handlers back in 2016 got him to buy into that, it's neither here nor there. He didn't do it. Last night was, he was throwing haymakers from the beginning. If you throw haymakers at the beginning, get more into the boxing metaphors now. You see how we do this? If you throw haymakers from the beginning, you better connect. I mean, you better connect big time. Because if you don't, and you let the guy or the gal, survive, it's tough. Joe Biden is a good debater. So, A, you didn't get Sleepy Joe last night. You didn't. You got a guy who obviously had taken care of himself over the past couple of weeks, had done copious debate prep, I would think, laid very low, only did one early morning, only did one appearance a day. So the Biden team probably went in and crossed their fingers. And Biden, again, he had some negatives last night, too. Reading going into the debate last night, one of the things the Biden people were worried about was his temper. And, yeah, his temper did, he got his dander up a little bit. But he also fell back to a tactic that he loves to use. And I mentioned this to you yesterday because I was doing some reading. And again, I remember the one debate. Remember, he didn't do a series of debates in 2012 or in 2012 or 2008. He did one with Sarah Palin, which at the time, I remember after the Palin debate, people said, wow, that was pretty good. That was a good exchange. You know, Joe had it. He notched it back. He knew he was debating a woman. And him and Palin, I remember the media saying, boy, she actually acquitted herself pretty well. But again, it was a tactic he used, and I mentioned this yesterday. It was a tactic that we saw in the Paul Ryan debate in 2012 and some of the Democratic debates this year that he fell back on. I'll tell you about that straight ahead. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. 216 traffic and weather together on the sixes. It's a midweek Wednesday on WICC. As I continue to give you my early thoughts on the train wreck of a debate we had last night, and I know there are people trying to parse, well, the president had him off balance on this and he made good points. Yeah, but it was a train wreck. Because people remember lines and points in a debate when things are quiet and civil. They do. Lloyd Benson's shot at Dan Quayle those years ago. Senator, I knew Jack Kennedy, you're no Jack Kennedy, whatever, but you still lost the election. But people remember that. That was said in a dead quiet auditorium. In a civil way. You know, Gerald Ford debate where he said, and I don't remember how exactly he said it, I'm paraphrasing, Poland is not under communist domination, or Eastern Europe is not under communist domination. People forget that because of, you know, people remember that rather, I'm sorry, because of the starkness of it. You heard it. There was almost an audible kind of, oh, he just said that. Why, that, you remember that. That's a point in that debate. Right? Yeah, I mean, when things are said quietly and surgically, I guess that would be the word, surgically, that's when, you know, people tend to remember that stuff. Ronald Reagan and his famous, well, there you go again. I mean, he didn't yell, he didn't scream. They had the line ready. And when, I forget whether it was Walter Mondale or Jimmy Carter, when they said something about Reagan's age, what was the line he had ready? Something to the effect of, and again, excuse the imitation, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not going to let my opponent's relative youth and inexperience be a point of contention, whatever. You remember the line if you're old enough. So those lines aren't delivered with screaming or yelling or pounding. They're done surgically. Joe Biden last night did again what he did to Bernie Sanders as Sanders was attacking him in the Democratic run-up debates. He did again what he did to Paul Ryan in the VP debate back in 2012. What Mr. Biden will do, in fact, I even posted an article about this on my Facebook page, when he gets pinned back or he wants to defuse what anybody else is saying that he thinks could be a point made against him, what does he do? He doesn't talk. He sits back. He looks up and he smiles. And I told you about this yesterday. I said, watch if the president's trying to make a point, Biden just sits back and he goes, yeah. And he gets that big, all those big cap teeth, man, in front. He has that, he's got that old Irish Catholic smile there. And he doesn't say anything. And it works. It's very disarming. And it works. When you have tens of millions of people watching, it works. Now, they should know this. And I'm sure the professional debate prep people or the consultants they bring in who get paid thousands and thousands of dollars, they've broken down all of Biden's tape. And I'd be surprised if they didn't say, now, Mr. President, in 2012, look at what Joe Biden did to Paul Ryan when Paul Ryan was trying to make salient points about federal spending. And what Biden did back then is he sat back in the chair and he had that big smile and he kind of waved his hand and sometimes he peppers it with a little, come on, man. And it works. Now, how do you counter that? If you see Biden smiling and you're talking about something, I don't know, relatively heady, crime, poverty, spending, you know what you do? You stop. You stop. Dead air. Hear that? Dead air. You stop. And you say, Joe, you find this funny? That's it. That's it. You don't pound. You don't say, oh, what do you know? You start yelling. You just say, Joe, I'm talking about people who can't pay their bills here. Or you find urban violence where stores are trashed and police cars are trashed and burned and Molotov cocktails and cops are beaten up. You find this funny? I don't. You don't need to punch the guy in the nose every time. But, you know, we have a president, for whatever reason, he thought the sledgehammer was the way to go last night. And listen, again, I'll say it over and over again. Biden was not spectacular. He certainly wouldn't answer the question about packing the court. And if the president's team is smart, my line of attack would be Joe Biden wants to rig the Supreme Court. That's simple. Say, folks, if you elect Joe Biden, because he didn't deny it, and let him come out and say, well, rigging, we don't want to rig the court. Well, Mr. Vice President, what do you, well, you know, make him take a stand. And he wiggled away last night. And Chris Wallace wasn't good either. Although, listen, what was Wallace going to do? You had two old guys yelling at each other. Jeez, it was like Statler and Waldorf. You know the two old guys in the Muppets up there in the box? It was just, it's exactly what it was last night. But, Biden, he wiggled out of that. He kind of wiggled out of a couple of other questions. So use that. And I'm sure they will. But, again, the second debate coming up, the third debate. And, by the way, there wasn't, it's not surprising that right after that, Joe and Mika, Joe Scarborough, and that animal he wears on his head, and Mika, they're all saying, oh, don't debate, cancel the next couple of debates. And to Biden's credit, he said, no, we're going to debate. So good for him. But, man, that whole thing, to use yet another sports analogy, let's see, I've done hockey and football. Why not do tennis, Paul? Okay, that whole thing by the president last night was one big unforced error. The president was bad. Biden was okay, but he had his moments, too. And there you go. It just, you cannot have debates with candidates screaming at each other. And I don't know if you're a moderator, how you remedy this, because I'm sure the president's team will yes the organizers to death, and then he'll do what he wants. Still a lot of rearranging of the deck chairs here, ideas, what'll happen, what won't happen. The health department, the governor's office, the CIAC, about high school sports coming up both this semester, next semester. Now there's an idea for a really short run of regular football. Sean Patrick Boley joins us. Sean is a sports writer for GameTimeCT.com, Hearst Connecticut Media. He joined me a couple of weeks ago on the morning show. Sean, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Hey, how you doing, Paul? Thanks for having me on again.
Hey, no problem. Well, he was so really good the first time. I said, listen, he passed the test, so he'll be a regular now. Hey, yeah. Sean, listen, I'm trying to make heads or tails here about what the CIAC is proposing here. Can you break that down for my listeners? Am I seeing basically three kind of sub-seasons? How would they want this to work?
Well, it took them a little while to figure this out, and I think the fact that they were the threats of these independent club teams coming out, that they decided they needed to move on this. Well, basically what they've implemented here is the same things most states that have disallowed football in the fall to do, which is move a season to spring. Get some games in there, maybe about a month and a couple weeks, kind of sandwich them in between the spring season which is probably going to look like a limited winter season, and kind of sandwich them in there at the moment. So that's kind of like what a lot of other states are doing. I don't know why they took it this long to kind of figure that out, but that's kind of like what they want to do. And then extend the spring season out just a few more weeks than normal.
So are we looking, Sean, at what, four games for football, five, six? Is that what we're looking at? Because I'm reading this as a month season before the playoffs. Is that what I'm seeing here?
Yeah, what they originally planned when they wanted to play a season in the fall, when the CIC originally put that out, they planned on about a 4-6 game schedule. I think it was six. With a tournament experience, in quotes, which isn't really defined. It's an experience. Basically, they give you two postseason games without really having a real tournament, just to give everybody maybe a max eight games. In this case, with the spring being so tight there, I think they said four games and then a tournament experience, two games, which means you play two post. Everybody plays. It doesn't matter if you qualify or not. So basically, you're looking at six games over the course of about a month and a half.
The other sports too, Sean, are affected here. I see that, there are certain considerations here, I guess, for a hockey season, and then for the low risk sports too, baseball and girls softball and field hockey and all that.
Yeah, well, what they've done here is they're basically guaranteeing you a season, or at least trying to, because who knows what the metrics are going to be and whether we're going to be locked down again next spring. But what they're trying to do here is the CIC is saying if you're more than 40% of your games that are scheduled in the fall get postponed because of COVID concerns or for whatever reason, then they're going to push you to spring. You can try again in the spring. That's kind of like what they're doing here. As far as like hockey goes, I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure. It's a moderately high exposure sport. I don't really know what they're going to do for the winter. They're actually starting to hash that out now. But the winter season would probably, it's going to start a little earlier to accommodate this. They're going to do a winter season, at least try to. And it's going to start a little earlier, so I think around the week of Thanksgiving, maybe a week before that, they would start practicing and then start games, like, just maybe about a week or so earlier. I'm not really sure what that's going to entail. If it's anything like football, it's going to be a mess, Paul. go ahead.
And I was going to say, and the big thing, Sean, is they have to ask the coronavirus for hockey if they really want to get up at 6 in the morning or 5 in the morning and get ice time and go to the rink
for practices. There have been a lot of club teams AAU, whatever, not AAU, but you know what I'm saying, lot of, like, junior league teams. There's been a lot of hockey played in the state over since the governor reopened July 6th. And then we've seen a couple issues here spark up. I know there's some out-of-state teams came in, and, there were some issues with that. But for the most part, from what I understand, it seems to be okay. I haven't really seen anything. Yeah, so we'll see about hockey. Basketball is going to be tricky. Now you're indoors, and it's going to deal with the same thing you have for volleyball. I just hope by then the metrics remain low to the point where you're like, all right, let's see if we can – get this season. Remember, those kids lost their whole entire postseason last year.
Yeah, yeah. We'll do more. Sean, hang on. One more segment with you, please. Sean Patrick Boley writes for GameTimeCT.com and, of course, Hearst Connecticut Media, one of the great high school writers in the state. Sean, back with you momentarily. First, traffic and weather together. 3:36 on WICC. So it appears the CIAC has some sort of a game plan here to maybe get all the sports in some way, starting in a few weeks, stretching into the spring with some shifting going around. They won't be full seasons. Sean Patrick Boley joins us for a few more minutes from GameTimeCT.com and Hearst Connecticut Media. Sean, I wonder, and maybe you've talked to some coaches or some athletes on this, to the high school athlete who... on any level, D1, D2, or even D3, who wants to continue playing in college, I can imagine what sort of monkey wrench or sand in the gears this has been to athletes in Fairfield County, all across the state, who are trying to get a spot on a college roster here, but may not have much of a season if they haven't committed anywhere past their junior year.
Yeah, no, that's certainly been a massive issue as we go forward with this. And that's one of the main reasons why a lot of people really would rather that the CIAC tried to play, especially with the numbers in Connecticut, the COVID numbers. We've spoken to a bunch of kids. We're actually putting out a series in the first papers this coming week, that kind of details some of the issues that players have dealt with. And, we have one of the kids, he's from Brookfield, he's a quarterback. He got hurt, like, just a few games into his junior season. So he's got no film, for the most part, from his junior year. And now it doesn't seem like he's going to get a senior year unless they are able to play into spring. So it's really been tough. And he basically says, hey, he shows schools, he says, like, I'm interested in your school. And they're like, you just don't have any film. And that's been a major problem. And he's not the only one. So that's been a big issue, and it's certainly tough. And then they've extended, they've changed the recruitment periods around to try and figure this out. But a lot of schools, colleges are also in limbo when they try to figure out who's going with them. It's certainly a major mess. But as far as kids who need to get that extra year, that last year of film, it's going to be really rough for them unless they play in the spring.
Yeah, and people don't realize, Sean, it's in ways it's easier now. I've had some college athletes in my family who, you know, it's not like years ago where you had to send them film or send them some sort of video. Now your reels are put together. There are professional companies that do this, and they put them on YouTube, and they say, okay, here's my link. Give it a look. And I can just imagine, you know, with, you know, they have all this technology here, but they can't play any games. You know, they're not going to send them something for freshman year. I mean, that's just not going to happen.
No, certainly isn't, and that's why you see some of these teams or these school areas that they want to have a some sort of a fall season, so they're trying to go like a club route. You know, we didn't even mention that. That's been a thing that I saw last night. Meriden, despite what the CIAC has done, the CIAC is trying to head off the club route and by adding this spring season. Because they were going, they wanted to go clubbing, wanted to get film for their kids. They wanted to give their seniors a meaningful experience. But even Meriden has said, like, no, we're going to allow our kids to try and pursue that because there is no guarantees really of the, in the spring. So yeah, you're certainly dealing with an issue there.
And I did see, Sean, on something that was issued, I think, by the CIAC a couple of days ago. I was reading that online thing that, they're concerned about insurance issues, and you and I had talked about this last week on the morning show, that what do we do with equipment? Are they allowed to use the school's equipment? You know, if they use a school helmet or shoulder pads and there's something wrong with it, they sustain an injury, but it's not in a regular CIAC-sanctioned game. I mean, you're looking at billable hours and lawyers and so much of that as well.
Yeah, the CIAC in bringing spring sports into fall, when they made their announcement yesterday, they specifically mentioned that they had spoken to a legal advisor, a lawyers, to figure out, you know, what their take should be on that. And their lawyers were like, basically, like, we don't really think that should be the club option. Shouldn't be something that we should consider, and then schools should be discouraged from that because of those liability issues. Well, meanwhile, Meriden, as I mentioned, they approved the plan. They talked to their own lawyers. So their own lawyers are like, no, we don't see a too much of an issue there as long as they get insurance beforehand. So, you know, this is just equipment you're going to rent out to them, so you're not really as much as liable. I don't know. I guess it's shopping for lawyers now at this point. Before we're shopping for doctors, now we're shopping for lawyers to tell us one thing and the other. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of pushback from the CIAC. They would prefer, Paul, that everybody stays in regimented school-sponsored activities. They even said that, and they've encouraged these teams to please stay the course. We're going to try and get you a season in the spring, whereas a lot of these independent schools were counting on some of the coaches to coach for them. And now if the coaches coach on these independent schools, maybe they're not going to be involved because they need to have certain contact with their kids in the regular school. It's just – there's a lot of tug of war here going on, and it's just the whole thing's a mess.
And Sean, final question: what about the prep schools here? What about the Hopkins and the Hamden Halls and the Greenwich Country Days and all these prep schools around New Haven, Hartford, and Fairfield County? What's their philosophy on this? Because they're not, of course, governed by the CIAC.
No, they're not, and they still have to somewhat listen to what's going on at the state level. But even the governor Lamont has said, he's putting it on each district, but the CIA is an umbrella organization, so they took the tack that they weren't going to go. The prep schools, on the other hand, they've kind of taken a different tack. Some of them have decided to forego a season and then just have workouts and combines and maybe even like small scrimmages or such for their team. But I know some of the others are looking at actually playing games in the next few weeks here, beginning, I guess, maybe in 2 weeks. Cheshire Academy, Salisbury, Brunswick, I believe, is looking at the Brunswick and Greenwich. They're going to be playing some sort of games with you, maybe four, maybe up to six. It really all depends. So the kids who have gone to the prep schools are probably most likely going to get some experience. I mean, I think it's about a half split. I think the Choates probably aren't going to do it. Taft, maybe not. But I've heard a lot of schools looking at trying to play some sort of season.
Well, because the prep schools can afford their own bubbles, and you know they're putting up their bubble facilities. Right,
absolutely. You know, it's really interesting.
My son's a proud Hamden Hall grad, so you know I say it with tongue in cheek.
I live right next door.
Oh well, there you go. Yeah, take a look at the outside of the building. My tuition money paid for something there, just so you know that. Yeah. Sean Patrick Boley, GameTimeCT.com, Hearst Connecticut Media. Sean, thanks. We'll be in touch. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Absolutely, Paul. No problem.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Sean. Be good. There you go, folks. So I guess there's going to be, who knows, is there going to be some high school sports? Will you be able to go watch your son or your daughter, your grandson, your granddaughter, niece, nephew, or the kid next door across the street? If you're in Fairfield County or New Haven County, who knows? University Political Science Professor Scott McLean, who I've had on shows for years. Scott also handles the QU in D.C. program. Scott, how are you today? All's well, I hope?
Paul, my good friend, how are you, sir?
I'm good. And Scott, I don't know about you, but I'm hoping that they take a big flat screen TV and put that up right at the door to, like, the National Archives or somewhere in Washington. And we should just have that debate last night playing on a loop.
I was going through the transcript because I couldn't believe what I actually heard. I had to go back and check the actual transcript. And the transcript is you couldn't write a Saturday Night Live skit that was more like this thing. It's unbelievable. I actually think that I want to write a letter to Lorne Michaels at Saturday Night Live and say that your next skit for this Saturday should open up with two pro wrestlers dressed in suits and being totally serious and giving a beautiful debate for the first 5 minutes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And to me, that is the ultimate, because these two guys, pro wrestlers could have done better than those two.
Oh, my God. And Scott, obviously, the tactic you can see is Trump wanted to come out and rattle him. And he couldn't do it. Now, Biden was not great. He was good. The guy has debated like crazy over the years. But, Scott, I think that Trump or the president thought this was going to be Hillary again, and clearly it wasn't.
Yeah, I got to be honest. It's just a baffling non-plan that Trump had coming into this. I think you're right, though. We could go on and on and on about Trump's strategy. He did exactly everything I said on all the other shows and all the radio and TV that I did prior to the debate. I mean, just like you said, he was trying to throw off Biden, make him look senile, make him flub up or stutter or say something silly. And Trump would just sort of badger him until he just sort of melted. Well, you know, Biden didn't melt, although he did call Trump some names and told him to shut up. I'm not sure that hurt. That was unbecoming of Biden, but I think the headline still remains that Trump was an agent of chaos in that debate, and it was a non-debate.
And, you know, I don't know whether
the headline about the Proud Boys and his saying "stand down and stand by." I think, and we could go on for a whole other segment about what he really meant by any of that.
Yeah.
But the fact that Trump, in the story that you just did on live here, where Trump had to come out and try to explain it, but explain it by saying, "I don't know who the Proud Boys are."
Yeah.
That just shows that if you're coming back the next day to have to explain something you said, that's not good for your debate strategy.
Yeah. And you know what, Scott, I think clearly, I think he ascribes would be the word to this old adage, Scott, and I don't think it's particularly wise, but I remember reading a couple of months ago or a couple of years ago as to why candidates on the right are really hesitant to, talk off extremist groups on the right. And then you have those on the left who, may be attached to anti-Semitic groups or anti-Muslim groups, or whatever, and they treat them with kid gloves. You know, somebody said that there's that old adage of a politician say, "Well, hey, I don't pick my voters. The voters pick me." I think that Trump is just, he's got this fear, I think, Scott, of just if he says something against anybody who may vote for him, he sees this as something chipping away at his base, which I just think he has all wrong sometimes.
Well, I don't think there's any danger that they wouldn't vote for him. I think part of this problem, I mean, I don't know. I shouldn't be the one to talk, but You know, I think if he really didn't know who the Proud Boys were, why did he say that? Why did he? wouldn't dare admit that he'd made a mistake. That's just not in keeping with Trump. It had to be someone else's fault. But I mean, I think it was a low point in his presidency, not just a low point of the debate that moment. And that moment will be replayed every 4 years, just before every debate, as high and low moments from debate history. It's going to be that one more than this guy's a clown or shut up you.
Yeah.
That stuff that Biden said. But I'm more of a political scientist strategist of these parties, and I love breaking down these strategies. But to me, it was just baffling. I mean, I've heard some commentators on radio and who are on more of the Republican side say that, well, if Trump was just playing to his base. But, man, you got to do the math. If you look at polls or if you look at the population and demographics, just playing to Trump's base isn't going to be enough votes to win this election. He's got to reach out and expand his base and not just polarize between the two, because the break point right now is most likely a woman who's living in the suburbs and maybe has a high school or college education. And he did nothing to try to reach out or connect with that particular voter or that particular group of voters. I just think it was a crazy strategy, if he had a strategy at all.
Scott, hang on. We'll be right back with you. I want to get more into this. Scott McLean, Quinnipiac University, poli-sci professor, political strategist. He breaks it down for you. More with Scott straight ahead, 4:36 on Connecticut Today. More of the best post-debate coverage here, including Quinnipiac University political science professor Scott McLean, heads the QU in D.C. program as well. You know, Scott, if the president, I thought, had controlled himself a little bit more last night, there were openings to really, on substantive policy, go after Joe Biden. The question that Chris Wallace asked was pretty provocative on court packing for the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a moment there where, you know, Biden was kind of back on the ropes there. And, you know, the president talking about the law and order and the fact that he was getting, you know, endorsements from police organizations and, you know, challenging Biden on, well, Joe, what would you have done with coronavirus? You're talking about mine. What would you have done? But again, Scott, you know that as we talk, perception is reality. And it just it was a wasted effort.
It was missed opportunities, Paul. You're absolutely right. Trump had many good points, and he did have Biden flustering, and not just because of the interruptions and so on flustering. It was because he tried to hedge his and wiggle his way out of it. I think to be fair to Biden on the other side, is, you know, it listened to what Biden said or tried to say. He didn't say it very well, but why should we debate a general idea of packing the court when nobody's really proposed this? There isn't any legislation on it. That's further down the road. It's kind of in the abstract. But I understand we get back to tactics and strategy. I think that was the right tactic for Trump to do this. I would have advised him to do the exact same thing. Get Biden to down on the record saying something about packing, adding Supreme Court members. But I think it's and it'll come up again. But, you know, it is what it is.
The Commission on Presidential Debates, I don't know whether you heard this today, Scott, they put out a statement a little after 1 o'clock saying that they're going to look at ways to make the next two debates better, maybe tolerable. But the buzz now is that they may go to the more traditional debate format, Scott, where, okay, question one to one candidate and the other guy's microphone is off, so there's no crosstalk here. I wonder if either side would agree to this.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's a very brilliant insight. You know, if you change the rules, they say, no, I don't want to do it now. And it gives everyone a way out to, you know, that they don't really want to do it. I mean, I think Trump needs these debates more than Biden, but Trump seems not to make use of them. It's Trump that's, you know, let's face it. I mean, Trump is behind, and he needs to make a move to change the dynamic of this race and not in the way he tried to do it last night. So, yeah, I think that would be a great – actually, I hope that – you know, to me it's ironic that the Commission on Presidential Debates, their answer to everything is, well, add more structure, add more rules. I mean, really? Do you think that's going to contain Donald Trump? I don't think having more rules on Donald Trump is really the answer to Donald Trump. I mean,
can you imagine
someone who tramples on the rules? He doesn't care. Scott, go ahead. I'll break those too. I mean,
can you imagine like Biden's answering a question? Trump's mic is off, so he just walks over to Biden's podium and starts arguing with it.
Sure, why not? I mean, there's. The other, you know, and someone was like, well, that's not social distancing. I didn't see it, but the reports were that Trump's family were the only ones in the entire auditorium who refused to wear masks. Well, and they got away with it. And that was one of the rules, too. So I mean, only the Commission on Presidential Debate, these sort of straight-laced, oh, it's all bipartisan. We just need more rules. That will solve everything.
So you're not a fan. Hey, finally, Scott, the thing that fascinates me also about this race and the media coverage, because, you know, despite the fact that I blab my own idiotic opinions here 4 hours a day on the radio, I am a trained journalist. I was a reporter for years. I am shocked, Scott, at the, well, number one, the total lack of any general press pool, traditional open news conferences with Kamala Harris. She hasn't done one. And Joe Biden does these kind of structured, you know, his handlers are picking from a list of, you know, approved news people. And I try to explain to friends of mine, they said, this is unprecedented. You usually have a gaggle of reporters. You know, they say, tell him, you know, Trump will talk to a tree with a microphone. He doesn't care. But the isolation from any sort of questioning from the media here, Scott, is amazing, and they may get away with it. Maybe they know what they're doing.
Yeah, I've lost track of the last time Trump gave a regular press conference and not, you know, the thing on as he's walking to the helicopter or something. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I see it as a campaign that thinks that they don't have to do this.
Yeah.
So why take the chance? But I think it's probably gone on. It definitely has gone on too long. I mean, this is the time when the questions like yours and mine that says, what are they hiding from? Come on out. And this is the time to do it. And not under these controlled situations. And, you know, wear your mask, have your social distance, but have a real press conference and a real back and forth with smart reporters. And I think Biden can actually use those to show off. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. It's a shame. So many great institutions of our elections have gone by the wayside in this year. Not just the debate as being a non-debate, but there's, you know, the conventions. We're likely to have a weird contested inauguration. I shudder to think what's going to happen after this election. We won't even have, I think Trump has basically announced that he's going to challenge every single vote and try to get every questionable vote not to count. And that's just going to be a recipe for real chaos, crisis and conflict running all the way up to the inauguration day in January.
Yeah, it's going to be weird. Interesting times, they say. Scott McLean, Quinnipiac University. Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. We'll be in touch. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
It's always fun, Paul. Great talking to you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it. Like those words. Thank you. Appreciate that. Scott McLean, Quinnipiac University. As we've been telling you, we've told you a couple of times, we lost a friend to the program a couple of months ago, a gentleman who ran for governor twice in Connecticut, a really keen political mind, whether you agreed with him or not, and you could tell that by the outpouring of remembrances of Oz Griebel when Oz Griebel tragically died a few months ago after being hit while jogging by a motor vehicle. The gentleman who ran with him on the ticket last time, running in the lieutenant governor slot with Oz Griebel, Monty Frank is with him, and Monty has taken over as chair of SAMCT, the Serve America Movement. And one of the final times I had spoken to Oz on this program, he had talked about a questionnaire that was going to go out to Connecticut legislative candidates. Some of those questionnaires have now started to come in. And with that, we welcome Monty Frank to WICC. Monty, Paul here. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Paul. And, you know, I really appreciate that introduction. Oz and I didn't know each other before the campaign. I was a former Democrat. He's a former Republican. And mm-hmm. You know, so often when you have these marriages for political purposes, they don't end very well. But Oz and I developed a deep respect for each other, and he became a very, very close friend. And, you know, it was really nice to see the outpouring for Oz after his passing. I think he would have been embarrassed by it because he was such a humble guy. I think for all of us who loved Oz and the family, it was really nice to see. And, you know, he really took the bull by the horns with the SAM Connecticut Serve America movement, building up the Connecticut Task Force and really pushing for electoral reforms and democracy reforms. So, you know, we are carrying out that mission for Oz, and I think it's going to end up being Oz's legacy. And when the book is finally written, it will be that Oz really propelled Connecticut towards electoral reforms and democracy reforms, which will make a difference in people's lives.
Talk about Monty a little bit first and refresh us on, because Oz discussed this with me a number of times, the mission of the Serve America movement. There's a Connecticut chapter. Talk about that and what the aims are here as far as how we elect candidates.
Sure. You know, the Serve America movement was established in 2017, had run candidates for governor of New York. Oz and I were endorsed by SAM, statewide party status in New York, run hundreds of candidates in the elections, and we have 60,000 followers across 50 states and have raised money in order to support the operation and get the message out. You know, the mission of SAM is pretty simple, to create a competitive force to disrupt political extremism and self-serving politics. And if there's any sort of sense that, well, maybe the country isn't living in that tribal environment, you know, spend 5 minutes, if you could take it, watching the debate last night, and you walk away from that thinking, boy, what an embarrassment our political process has become, that we are not able to have a serious dialogue around issues that matter to the people of our country. And work toward solutions, and that we continue to devolve, we continually end up in this tribal warfare. And as a result, you know, we're left with major issues that are not getting solved.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, Monty, but doing shows like this as I have for years and trying to follow this and eat, drink, and sleep it as I do, it's so funny to me, and it just makes me shake my head. I often align or compare the push to make electoral changes or even consider them on an upper level where they can be really discussed and really maybe adopted in some level, maybe for a trial. I often compare that to the people who don't want to change anything, say, about Major League Baseball. Oh, it's sacred. You can't have the designated hitter. No, we can't have this runner at second rule. Oh, my God, the world's going to end. Well, no, I don't think the world's going to end. People are still going to watch baseball. And I think in some of these, Monty, in some of these things that you folks and Sam and Oz talked about with us here, some of these things are, listen, let's at least give them a shot, give them a somewhat of a vetting here. But you and I both know, and Oz talked about this with us a lot, the barricades to this, the stranglehold that the two-party system has, not only here in Connecticut, but all across the country, is just frustrating sometimes.
It sure is. It's interesting you mentioned baseball, because I don't know if you realize this or not, but Oz pitched in the College World Series and had a cup of coffee in the minor leagues. And he and I talked a lot about baseball. In fact, one of the last things I did before the lockdown is Oz and I went to a UConn basketball together and spent more time talking about politics and baseball than the game. But he was kind of looking at the game out of the corner of his eye and knew exactly what was going on. But, you know, getting back to the question, you know, Oz and I are a perfect example of why electoral reforms are so needed in this state. You know, here's a guy that new policy in Connecticut, better than any other candidate. It's probably better than any candidate who's run for governor in the last 20 years. He knew Connecticut. He was on major boards of nonprofits. He was a smart guy with an incredible amount of integrity. I still haven't met the guy who doesn't like Oz. And so, you know, the fact that we got the current endorsement, we had enormous support. But people were scared to vote for us because they felt like, you know, they were throwing their vote away, that, you know, because of the stranglehold of the parties, that they were going to end up voting for the lesser of two evils rather than vote for the person that they really wanted to. And that really frustrated Oz. And so some of these electoral reforms that we are talking about will create more competition in our campaigns, more competition as it is in the capital markets, hopefully will create a better product. But it will open it up to more people who are able to vote and more candidates who are able to participate, and it will eliminate this wasted vote fear tactic that the parties use in order to discount the qualified third party.
Monty Frank is the guest. Monty, hang on. We'll be right back with you. He took over the reins of the Connecticut chapter of SAM, the chapter, the local chapter of Serve America Movement. We'll talk about this questionnaire and the questions on it straight ahead, right here. Traffic and weather together, 516 on WICC. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. We'll get back to a last half hour of open phones straight ahead. First, though, a few more minutes with a gentleman who ran for lieutenant governor last time around in Connecticut alongside the late Oz Griebel on that ticket. Monty Frank joins us. So, and by the way, Monty and Oz jump-started the Connecticut chapter of SAM, the Serve America Movement, looking to at least get folks to consider some electoral tweaks and changes. So, Monty, you had a questionnaire that went out to candidates asking them some basic questions. And I went over this last time I had Oz on the show. So let me just go over these quickly. Connecticut should abandon partisan primaries and move to a single taxpayer-funded nonpartisan primary in which all candidates and all voters participate. Connecticut should adopt ranked choice voting to ensure that winners of all elections have the support of a majority of voters and not just a simple plurality. Question three was, Connecticut should adopt term limits, amen, for our six constitutional offices of governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and yes, the General Assembly. And finally, Connecticut should adopt a vote by mail option. Well, we've kind of been pushed into that one. That is secured against political abuse and fraud for federal and state elections. What, Monty, has been the response to these questions?
The questionnaire went out to all candidates running for statewide office and the General Assembly. It went out, and earlier this week, we've gotten about 20 responses so far. The responses so far are interesting. But, you know, with respect to these electoral reforms, boy, would it improve our democracy. It would improve competition, more people involved. We would end up with a better General Assembly. We'd end with a better government. And presumably at the end of the day, we'd end up with a much better state.
I have read opinions now, because I think Maine is doing it, Monty, the ranked choice voting. I have read opinions ranging from "this is wonderful, we should have been doing this years ago" on one side to "this is an absolute abomination that will destroy the country." So no surprise there. but you want to generate talk about this, right?
Well, the results are there. So if you look at, you know, my situation when I ran with Oz, you know, if I had a dime for every person who came up to me and said, "I wanted to vote for you, but I was worried that I was throwing my vote away," well, ranked choice voting would have given the opportunity to vote for us as number one. And then they could decide the lesser of two evils between Bob Stefanowski and Ned Lamont. But what it does is, and this is why it would work so well in this current political climate, is that it forces candidates, if they want to be successful, not to automatically go to the right or to the left, but they've got to compete for votes in the center. They've got to look to see, okay, if I go really far to the right, I'll get a bunch of number one votes from the hardcore Republicans or the hardcore Democrats, but I'm not going to get a lot of number two or number three votes. And what in order to win with ranked choice voting, you ult through the automatic runoff process that is generated, you ultimately have to get more than 50%. So you get the majority instead of a plurality.
Yeah.
And it forces people to play nice in the sandbox and actually talk about substantive policy issues that will make a difference for the people of the state of Connecticut.
And Oz, and I'm sorry, Monty, there are, I know, some localities in some states that I read that kind of do this for some elections. And a form of this is done in other countries, right? In Europe and other countries. Am I right or wrong about that?
Oh, you're absolutely right. New York City just passed a referendum to allow it in some of their municipal elections. There are various forms of this. And, you know, if I had my preference, to me, you have a single taxpayer-funded nonpartisan primary where the top four emerge to a general election, then you have ranked choice voting in the general election. That process would produce a government, whether it be from a state rep or for a governor's race, that would be so far superior than anything we've seen. And you know, you look at the successes of this in other parts of the country. California, for example, has a top two single taxpayer funded nonpartisan primary system. The progress that has been made in terms of collegiality, compromise, transparency, accountability, and getting things done in the state house in California, if you compared it now to what it was 10, 15 years ago before they implemented these democracy reforms, it's night and day. And we could see that in Connecticut. We could go to a point in time where we have the best and the brightest in our political offices, where compromise is a desired goal, where accountability and transparency are judged by the voters because they're able to do that because they have much more of a voice in the political process.
The website is joinsamct.org. Run it all together, joinsamct.org. The group is the Serve America Movement. Heading the Connecticut chapter is former Lieutenant Governor Candidate Monty Frank. Monty, good to talk to you, and be safe. We'll talk to you down the road and stay in touch. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Monty. Appreciate it. Monty Frank, there you go, taking over for Oz Griebel, who passed away a few months ago. Got hit by a car while jogging. Please, folks, be careful out there.